Greetings, my name is Nathan Hatch. I'm president of Wake Forest University, and I'd like to welcome you to the Character and the Professions Conference, co-hosted by the Oxford Character Project and the Program for Leadership and Character at Wake Forest University. This is part of an ongoing partnership to promote leadership and character development. It is indeed a pleasure to join together in this important discussion about ethical leadership as it pertains to particular professions. First, let me thank the many outstanding scholars who have devoted their time to share their insight and expertise with us over the next few days. I'm also grateful to the support from the Lilly Foundation and the Kern Family Foundation that has made this event possible. Additionally, I am grateful for the efforts of so many who have worked to bring this conference to fruition, including Michael Lamb and Kenneth Townsend, both here at Wake Forest. Dozens of offices, programs, and departments, along with the partnership of countless others, have organized and arranged for an inspiring time of learning and conversation around character and their professions. Leadership and character have been areas of interest of mine for quite some time. Forming leaders to enter into the professional world is the work of educational institutions. At Wake Forest, we have been committed to a twofold approach of preparing professionals. First, we teach skills and expertise needed to execute work at the level of excellence. Then we hope to focus on the role that individual character and virtue play in shaping the professions. A professional at some level has a moral commitment of service to the public that goes beyond the test of the market or the desire for personal profit. The ideal of the professions is that they serve the common good, the care of the infirmed, the promotion of justice and the advancement of science. Pursue the study of the law rather than the gain of it. Jeremy Gridley, the leading lawyer in Boston, advised the fledgling attorney John Adams before his admission to the bar. In our world today, we need lawyers, doctors, ministers, engineers, politicians, and business people who are superb practitioners but also committed to the highest standards of their profession, and to broader ways the professions are committed to the common good. In this spirit, I'm indeed grateful that all of you have made this conference a priority. I look forward to our time exploring what we can learn from one another about the character within the professions. So once again, welcome. We're delighted that you have joined us.
Thank you, President Hatch, for those words and for all that you have done to make this conference possible. As some of you know, this Character in the Professions conference has been inspired and shaped by the life, work, and legacy of President Hatch. Thank you. My name is Kenneth Townsend, and I'm Director of Leadership and Character in the Professional Schools and Scholar in Residence in the Law School here at Wake Forest. When we began planning this conference in collaboration with the Oxford Character Project, over a year ago, we had no way of knowing that a pandemic would sweep the world and limit our ability to gather in person. While we regret that we are unable to welcome you to our campus here at Wake Forest, we are grateful that this virtual format has allowed us to reach more people than we had originally planned. As of about an hour ago, over 2,200 had registered for this conference, representing 37 countries and every continent on Earth except for Antarctica. We're grateful for the excitement surrounding this conference and are looking forward to the next few days. This conference would not be possible, as President Hatch noted, without the support of a lot of people, including our funders and foundation partners. In particular, we want to thank the Lilly Endowment, the John Templeton Foundation, and the Kern Family Foundation. It is because of their generosity that we have been able to make this conference free for you all. We also want to thank the 18 external partners beyond Wake Forest who have partnered with us in various ways. Thank you. Thanks also to the 36 departments, schools, offices, centers, and programs at Wake Forest that have partnered with us. We encourage you to take a look at the conference partners section on our registration website to see all of the people and entities who have played a role in preparing for this week's conference. Now it is my privilege to introduce Dr. Ed Brooks. Ed is Executive Director of the Oxford Character Project at the University of Oxford. His research lies at the intersection of virtue ethics, character, and leadership development. He heads up research and programming efforts at the Oxford Character Project and has designed and delivered leadership development programs at universities and organizations around the world. Ed, thank you to you and the Oxford Character Project for all that you have done to make this conference possible. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Kenneth, and for that generous introduction. It's an honor for the Oxford Character Project to be co-hosting this conference along with our colleagues and our friends at the Programme for Leadership and Character at Wake Forest University. This is now the third conference we have hosted together, and it is an absolute privilege to work in partnership with you all once again. I would particularly like to thank President Hatch for his opening words and moreover for all he has done over many years as an ambassador for character and leadership. In Oxford, we have benefited greatly from your work, Dr. Hatch, and have much appreciated your support. My thanks also to Dr. Michael Lamb and Dr. Kenneth Townsend, along with your formidable team at Wake Forest, for your work in organizing what is set to be an excellent conference, and to the foundations and supporters that have already been mentioned for making this event possible. The Oxford Character Project is an interdisciplinary initiative here at the University of Oxford, focusing on character and leadership development. Our empirical and conceptual research is joined to programs that draw together diverse groups of students with the aim of cultivating wise thinkers and good leaders. We're currently undertaking a major research project supported by the John Templeton Foundation on character and responsible leadership in business, finance, law, and technology. So the theme of character and the professions is right at the center of our interest. Over the next 2 days, we have an incredible group of speakers and panelists. I'm grateful to them for their work and all they will bring to us. And I'm much looking forward to learning together with all of you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ed. Again, we're so grateful for this partnership and collaboration. So as Ed outlined, over the next couple of days, we are gonna have a lot of fun, I hope, answering, exploring a few questions, such as what obligations do professionals have for advancing the public good? What distinctive virtues are most important to ethical leadership for professionals? What vices are most dangerous or tempting? How can character be educated or improved among current or aspiring professionals? How do specific institutions, incentives, and cultures form or deform the character of professionals? As we explore these questions and others, we are fortunate to have with us leading scholars from the world's top universities, as well as professionals at the top of their field whose daily work implicates these and other considerations of character. As you've seen in the promotional materials, our exploration will focus on character in public life, religious leadership, engineering and technology, medicine, business, and law. And we will hold a plenary session tomorrow night focused on diversity and character in the professions. And while this conference is free, we are providing continuing education credits for a small fee to those in engineering, medicine, and law. To learn more and to register for these continuing education credits, visit our registration website. So now at this point, we are just going to transition right on into the first substantive session of our conference, Character and Public Life. So for any of you who are just coming into the Zoom meeting, who didn't show up for our Zoom introduction, let me just briefly say welcome to you as well. We are so glad that you could be part of this conference. My name is Kenneth Townsend. For those just joining, I'm Director of Leadership and Character in the Professional Schools and Scholar in Residence in the Law School. I'm not going to go through the whole spiel of the introduction, but I want to say here as well that we have over 2,200 people registered from 37 different countries. We are so excited about the excitement for this conference and grateful to have you as part of it. And on behalf of the Oxford Character Project as well, I'm pleased to welcome you formally to Character in Public Life, featuring the keynote address by Professor Eric Bierbaum of Harvard University. followed by a panel of distinguished leaders and scholars from a variety of contexts who will offer their perspectives on character and public life. We do hope that you'll stay with us after Professor Bierbaum's presentation concludes so that you can participate in the panel conversation. There will be time following Professor Bierbaum's presentation, for the audience to ask questions. So look for the Q&A utility at the bottom of your Zoom screen. And also for those just joining with the support of Wake Forest Program in Interpreting and Translation Studies, we are offering live interpretation in Spanish and Chinese. Look at the bottom of your Zoom screen for questions or how to do that. Now it is my distinct honor to introduce Dr. Eric Bierbaum. He is professor of government and faculty affiliate in the Department of Philosophy at Harvard University. He has also served as the director of graduate fellowships at Harvard's Safra Center for Ethics and was the founding director of Safra Center's undergraduate fellowship program. For his excellence in teaching, he received the Rosalind Abramson Award, Harvard's most prestigious undergraduate teaching award. His talk today is entitled Gaslighting, a Character Attack on Citizenship. Welcome, Professor Bierbaum. We're so glad to have you.
Thank you so much, Kenneth. Thank you, President Hatch. And I'm just grateful to the Center for leadership and character. This is a truly global conference. Like the Center itself, thinking about leadership and character, as someone who works on political ethics, it is a peak time where people think it's an oxymoronic project to devote your scholarly pursuits to combining these traits, but that's what I've done, that's what I try to do. And I wanna draw a parallel to a book published by my two colleagues, Steve Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt 4 or 5 years ago, and that's How Democracies Die. In that book, they argued that they were gonna talk about the way, use the very institutions of democracy to gradually, subtly, and legally kill it. And they described in some ways how democracies die. And in this talk, I wanna share parts of a book project that I'm working on with Ryan Davis at BYU, a colleague who's center right, whereas I am more center left, but we found a way, a common ground on this co-authored project to think about, you might say, why democracies die, to look at how we have a certain kind of manipulation that can use a core character trait of citizenship to also gradually, subtly turn citizens against themselves and their co-citizens. That's the kind of brand of manipulation I want to talk about today. And of course, it comes from a play and a movie with Ingrid Bergman playing the star. In that movie, the victim comes to depend upon the manipulator in a very perverse way, rather than her own capacities. And if you look at the appeal to gaslighting as a moral accusation in politics, it's remarkable. In a data set of hundreds of millions of social media posts with colleagues looking back at 2011, the concept was barely uttered in that world, in that universe. But as you watch it expand with key dates we've marked in our political calendar, you can see it's really receiving something like millions of appeals every day. And so I want to take that concept seriously. Why are people invoking something called gaslighting rather than deception and other kinds of traditional political terms that have been around as long as politics? One late night political commentator writes, we're constantly being told, you don't see what you see, you don't hear what you hear. Now they're saying you don't feel what you feel. And I think it's important to give a name to these kinds of moral abuse. Concepts matter. And when concepts are available, they allow us to better understand what's happening to us. So think of the concept of sexual harassment, which is a relatively recent concept. Before that existed, it was much harder for people to recognize that they were being subject to this kind of moral abuse. I think something is similar here, that this kind of manipulation has no proprietary hold by one party or the other. In fact, we've noticed in our look at that data set that both parties are accusing other members of it. And so my argument, because political theorists are not good novelists, we tend to reveal our punchline at the beginning, is that gaslighting exploits a certain kind of character trait that's essential to citizens, a kind of grit, which allows citizens to hold beliefs that are what I'm going to call audacious. And those beliefs are about their ability to act together collectively. And so my talk is going to unfold in three parts. And I use this metaphor, this analogy guardedly, but think of the virus's spike protein and the way that it takes healthy cells and fools them by using that protein. Something similar, I think, is happening with gaslighting. It seizes upon what I'm going to argue is a healthy and vital trait of citizenship, this kind of optimism, believing that we can be part of social change. and it turns it against itself and a threat that is potentially existential for a democracy. And that's why I say that the virus does present a very disturbing metaphor for it. So I'm going to first talk about how gaslighting works. I'm going to talk about the way it targets this particular civic virtue. And then I'm going to finally conclude with how leaders can mobilize citizens, can activate the virtue without this kind of manipulation that's so disturbing. So in the movie, Ingrid Bergman plays a victim who believes the lights have been flickering. That's because of her nefarious husband. But someone they respect insists they don't flicker. And eventually, after being worn down over time, the victim is never able to prove the lights flicker and comes to doubt fundamental sensory inputs. And note how this kind of manipulation works, right? It takes advantage of a very healthy norm of intimate relationships. You should trust your partner. An emotionally abusive partner, though, will manipulate that trust and to harm their significant other. And that's what happens in this domestic setting. And of course, the challenge of this talk is to show you that it scales to our political democratic life. But here's how it works in the intimate setting. Generally, when someone you respect disagrees with you, you should revise your confidence in your initial belief, whether they're a friend or a lifelong partner. That is a character trait that actually constitutes being a friend. You might think that if you didn't revise your confidence when you faced this disagreement, you wouldn't actually be showing evidence that you were friends. But that's the point of vulnerability here in this domestic setting. You can come to lose confidence in yourself, in your judgments, in your capacities, and form a very unhealthy dependent relationship with the abuser. And so I might want to distinguish in the domestic case, we all experience doubts about the world. Are we wrong? But that's very different from being in a state where we can't get to the truth, where we've lost touch with reality in a certain kind of way. So imagine, and this really is a hypothetical in this day, that you leave the house and you come to doubt whether you turned off the stove after leaving the house. Let's say your memory is a bit fuzzy, whether you turned it off, but you typically will have other routes to check that. You might ask whether you cleaned the stove, which you remember. And if you cleaned it, that's fairly solid evidence that you also didn't leave it on before you cleaned it. And so you have a route back to the groundedness of reality. And what gaslighting can do, and this is the philosopher Kate Abramson's claim, is that it leaves us not just mistaken, but entirely without grounds, without a way to get back to the groundedness with reality. Reminds me of the joke of the person who's lost and comes to get directions and is told, if I wanted to get there, I wouldn't start from here. That's one of the treatment effects of this kind of abuse. So I want to just introduce in this talk one term of philosophers of belief, and I'm going to be limited how many I introduce, higher order evidence. And that is our evidence about our evidence. And so just very simply to illustrate it, because I think this is what gaslighting targets, this is what's unique about the strategy of the gaslighter, is that instead of going after particular beliefs we have and lying to us about them, they step up a level and they target our ability to ground evidence by which we hold those beliefs. So think about in a word processor, a bash delete, as opposed to individual formatting. So if I want to convince you that the wall behind me is green, I could lie at the first order, but if I really want to have a more pervasive impact upon your sensoriness of input of the world, I might convince you you're colorblind and you would come to doubt that capacity. And so here's the formal kind of analytic description of gaslighting I want to work with, and that is an agent wrongly induces another agent to doubt their ability to respond rationally to evidence by providing higher order defeating considerations, which I'll say a bit about in a second, about their reasoning capacities. And so there's a general sense in which you're not just locally reliable about a particular judgment, but you want to convince the person they're generally unreliable. And the best way to illustrate this beyond this formulation is the Peanuts comic. In particular, this particular comic inspired my favorite song in the great Broadway play, You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, Little Known Facts. So Lucy says, do you see this tree? It's a fir tree. It's called a fir tree because it gives us fur for clothes, coats. It also gives us wool in the wintertime. Linus, the victim of this attempted gaslighting, says, I never knew that before, Lucy. It's very interesting. Charlie Brown, the bystander to gaslighting, says, wait a minute, Lucy, I didn't mean to interfere, but she continues, and the way up, the little stars and planets make the rain that often showers when it's cold and winter is upon us. The snow comes up just like the flowers from the ground. And Charlie Brown once again tries to stop her. Now, Lucy, I know that's wrong. Snow doesn't come up, it comes down. She continues, the wind blows around and looks like it's coming down, but actually she offers an explanation. She's trying to convince him, don't trust your senses. It comes out of the ground, just like grass. It comes up, Charlie Brown, snow comes up. And Charlie Brown concludes, oh, good grief. He leaves the scene and you can hear a hollow thumping sound, which is his head hitting that very tree. So I think what's important here is that gaslighting as a kind of manipulation can affect audience members and wrong them in different ways. It has the direct victim who comes to doubt the reliability, sometimes of basic sensory inputs, but it also can wrong bystanders who feel helpless when they try to stop this kind of manipulation and the experience of futility when truth is not serving as a terminal objection, which is usually meant to serve, which is if you say something that's false, that usually should be enough to stop them from making claims. And I think Charlie Brown feels that powerlessness in this example. And so in the political setting, and that's the move I'm going to make now, we saw initially a claim about crowd size, and a political scientist asked partisans on the left and right, which crowd is bigger? And they identified 15% of supporters that were supporting Trump insisted upon the crowd on the right being larger. That might be a kind of cheerleading acknowledgement. We should acknowledge that. There was a question when the Queen was left waiting, but in fact, we were told that the Queen showed up late. There's the fact that there may be much lower vaccine uptake rates right now as we speak. And there's the case of the January 6th Capitol insurrection, where many of the insurrectionists seem to be in the grip of an alternative electoral reality. You go through the signs and a lot of the social media footage, I think it backs that up. But it's important to report, this is a bipartisan phenomenon. Partisans on both sides can be led to misrepresent some basic sensory inputs. So an example, an experimental example by a colleague, asked people effectively, what is the temperature, local temperature in your neighborhood? What's it been like recently? And in the control, in the experiment where they offer a variable, they prime people to think about climate change. And they find that people who lean towards the Republican Party are more inclined to report a cooler environment, right? Local environment. And the same thing applies on the other side, that if they prime Democrat voters, they think perhaps they report a warmer climate than they otherwise experience. So here's the analogy to politics. And that's simply, I'm taking the initial formulation I gave and now applying it to a political actor who wrongly induces citizens to forego exercising their rational capacities by providing higher order defeating considerations about those capacities. And so what is a higher order defeater? Well, it's akin to what we got from Lucy, where she actually, remember at that moment, takes Charlie Brown and says, you think the snow looks like it's coming down. She kind of acknowledges that sensory input, but then she corrects him and says, that's false. If you think about it again, you'll see actually snow is raining upward. And I want to argue that this kind of gaslighting can range over our attitudes, our emotions, our beliefs, and even our moral convictions, right? So it's not just about beliefs about the world, it's about how the world should be. And I want to distinguish political gaslighting from mere deference or utterly familiar party cue taking, where I accept what many elites in my party argue for. In that case, you would expect if I change my attitude about a phenomenon, say I shift my views about climate change and about man-made carbonization, its contribution to it, you might think that once I've done that, I then will have some stability. I'll have something, what you might think of beliefs. Beliefs have a stickiness. But if I'm in this kind of very perverse relationship of deference, I can tack in either direction, right? I have no regard for accuracy. Now, here's an objection that you might already be experiencing when you hear this analogy I'm drawing, and that is that it seems like, at least in many cases, citizens subject to the kind of gaslighting I'm describing in political life retain confidence or even exhibit hyperbolic confidence in their political beliefs. And so I want to answer in two ways. First of all, I think that's true, and it requires us to acknowledge that the way that confidence shifts can be radically inflated or deflated in the context of gaslighting in the political realm. So there is a modification there. But I also would say that functionally, even if gaslit victims, ordinary citizens, express to pollsters greater confidence in beliefs, they don't seem to act like they have confidence in their beliefs because they're subject to be flipped on any given issue, on free trade, on issues regarding immigration. It seems like if they can they can move those issues so quickly that they aren't really showing a confidence in the beliefs that they've been brought to have. And in that context, then, the threat here, the real threat to citizenship is the following. It looks like our independent perspective is compromised by this phenomenon. The language that you might use is that we usher ourselves off when we're a victim of gaslighting in politics, off the deliberative stage, and we withdraw from democratic politics by becoming such a supplicant to others. Now, I want to state a background condition that I think makes this environment right now a target-rich environment for this kind of manipulation, and that, of course, is a polarized environment. And I think the relationship between these two phenomena, which is an active debate in American political science, is the following. I think that gaslighting is very frequently the spark, especially in the context of social media, but the background of polarization is the oxygen. And so if you consider the very tragic 1968 cabin fire in one of the Apollo missions, and that led to killing the entire crew, that was a high pressure, pure oxygen cabin atmosphere. And all it took was a spark of a wire to set it off. And I think that this hyper-polarized environment we're in is a rich environment for this kind of manipulation. Because what it does, it pushes citizens towards what's been called directional motivation versus accuracy motivation by political scientists. So a directionally motivated individual, a citizen, is not paying regard towards empirical facts. They are not sensitive to accuracy. And I think that's the background that makes this possible. So let's look at what is being targeted by gaslighting. I've described the phenomenon, but now in the political case, what is its sort of core target? Because after all, you might think that there's a very, very easy way for citizens to fortify themselves against this phenomenon. And that is, if gaslighting threatens to undo the connection between our beliefs and our evidence, well, shouldn't we just firmly double down and ensure that our beliefs are tightly connected to the evidence? We should be like many of my hard-nosed empiricist colleagues. The problem is that a central civic virtue of all of us is to be able to mobilize. And mobilization, I'm going to try to argue, requires at times some gap between our beliefs and the evidence. To show this, imagine if you want to climb Mount Everest or you want to complete a marathon. Each day of training, you are going to encounter possible defeaters, that is evidence that you're not going to make it. And it seems healthy for you to, if you want to firmly have that belief, at least that you will not fail, and perhaps a stronger belief that you will succeed, you may have to occasionally not take your doctor seriously when they say, I'm not sure if this is going to work out for you. And so what that is exhibiting is called by the philosopher Jennifer Morton and Sarah Paul grit. And you might think crucial to achieving our interpersonal goals is that we are allowed, they would say rationally permitted, to raise the threshold for evidence in order to make it the belief that our success is reasonably likely, right? So when people around me say, you know, I don't know how optimistic you should be about completing that marathon, I might be able to raise the bar and say, you know, I still believe as an agent, I have a chance of completing it. And I should allow some slack between the evidence about my physical state now and my beliefs. So we're going to call that audacious beliefs. And what they say is that it's sometimes permissible to have what you might think of as overconfidence in the success that we will as individuals be successful in our projects. So think of when Han Solo is told by C-3PO in The Empire Strikes Back, the possibility of successfully navigating an asteroid field is approximately 3,720:1. And Han Solo says, never tell me the odds. Now, I think he resists this evidence because he's worried it might lead him to abandon the project. He knows his odds are vanishingly small, but he wants to retain this project, this commitment. And so he is asking, to in some ways, be protected from that evidential source, or at least to raise the bar for what counts as evidence against his project. And so what we're looking for here is the analog to that, what you might call civic grit. And a natural place to look is the Montgomery bus boycott, which lasted extraordinarily long, 381 days, even though the night before, the first day of the boycott, the general thought, even among the group, was that it would last one day, maybe a week at best. If you look at the initial flyers, and just to stress the logistics behind it, 1955, Joanne Robinson mimeographed 52,000 leaflets like this, and they were distributed to 68 Black social organizations across Montgomery. And the boycott was planned to last one day officially, and it lasts almost 400 days. And once you look at the complexity behind it, a vast carpool network, 325 private cars transporting passengers from 42 distinct stations, and 42 stations from 5 in the morning to 10 at night. You see the grit that was required and the overwhelming evidence that this was not going to be sustainable for weeks or months or longer. And yet it was. Likewise, when Martin Luther King famously wrote that the arc of the moral universe bends towards justice, I think it's misleading to think that he's just announcing, when he looks at the world and looks at the amount of racism of a structural kind, that he ought to believe this view. I don't think this is simply a hard nosed statement of how he thinks the world is likely to accord with future reforms. I think he's expressing a commitment to, in some ways, believe against the evidence, or at the least to believe ahead of the evidence in front of him. And if you look at his exchange with the Black Power movement, rejection of nonviolence and rejection of this thought that the world could bend in this way, I think you can see evidence of a mindset that supports this belief. So this is a kind of second paradigm, along with Rosa Parks and all her backers, of, I think, paradigmatic grit or audacious beliefs of citizens. That leads me to the final question. I want to flip from the victim of the citizen now to the leader, which is obviously a centerpiece of this conference, and to ask the question of how leaders can do two things at once. They can simultaneously mobilize, but also in the process not to gaslight citizens. And I'm going to argue that it's not an easy steering between these two horns, but there is some evidence to think of how it might work in practice. So think about the plentiful political science that suggests that voters turn out when they have very high confidence that many of their fellow citizens will also turn out. And you might think that to formulate the expression that one must have, what's the collective version of this audacious belief, is something like this. The leader might say to followers, "I believe that we will succeed. I know you share my confidence." They won't likely announce that it's overconfidence, but they might realize that there is a sense in which it's really important to have efficacy-driven slogans like, "Yes, we can." And I don't think these should be passed over as cheap talk or overblown rhetoric. I think that expression of confidence is what makes possible signals to others and what allows them to solve the classic collective action problem of citizenship. I mean, I think that just as you might think that I'm not willing on my own to go on a base jump, it just sounds too terrifying to do on my own. But if we agree that we're all going to jump on the count of 5, and I'm looking over for you for that signal, you're going to do it, well, that's going to sustain my confidence. And so you might look at the portfolio of the protester, the rallies, the speechifying marches, and you might think that that's also kind of proof of concept that I want a signal that we will succeed. And when the evidence looks like it's fundamentally stacked against us, the fact that I retain that what I've called the kind of civic grit is exactly what I have to keep doing. But notice what's happening there. This is the puzzle that we have to solve in the final section of this. And that is that when you look at gaslighting and the techniques employed by the gaslighter, you might think that there is an awful similarity to the mobilizer. And I want to show how those can be teased apart. Otherwise, we might have what looks like kind of the duck rabbit problem. You look at the drawing and you can see either one, but I really want to keep those apart because I think one of them is a kind of abusive citizenship and the other is a prerequisite of the kind of collective action that is behind citizenship. So that's the impetus for doing both. So here's an example of an exchange between a Latino canvasser and persuadable voters. And here's the report back from the canvasser. He wrote that I canvassed 18 individuals who are Mexicanos, Hispanos, and Asian couple, and they all opened their doors and they actually heard what I had to say. But more importantly, they were enjoying it. And they were like, okay, we're going to vote for that. It wasn't out of a jaded perspective and that no matter what we say, they're going to still do what they want. It was more, I feel what you're saying and I feel in what you believe now. And I was like, yes, it's important that we believe that we have the power to make changes instead of feeling like we're going to be continuously be inferior to everyone else. So I take this as a kind of paradigmatic exchange where a mobilizer is trying to exercise leadership by convincing individuals that not just you, but your neighbors can do this. And if once you view yourself as a collective, as jointly acting, you can really realize that this is something that we can do. If it's first personally expressed something I can do, it's likely to be futile. And so if what leaders need to do is cultivate that shared sense of collective self-efficacy, the civic grit that I've talked about, what are they allowed to do? What are they allowed to say? So if you imagine, we kind of cut off the conversation. Hypothetically, let's imagine two further conversations that could happen at the door between the canvasser and the canvassee. And here's the one that I think is an example of welcome mobilizing. We imagine the canvasser talking about ways that the speaker and the listener can make a difference through exercising their capacities in ways that would help them realize ends they selected themselves that they kind of own, and in ways that demonstrate their equality to other members of the political community. So that may create a genuine slack between the beliefs of canvassees and the evidence that they are going to succeed. The shocking political mobilization led by Abrams was not expected by the world. Some of the scripts did look like this. But here's how mobilizing can go wrong, and I think become much closer to or constitutive of gaslighting. Imagine instead that the mobilizer cites their leader and the interlocutor's shared loyalty to a specific individual, creating that dependent relationship, focuses on the efficacy of the leader rather than on the efficacy of the leader and listener together, and insists upon the importance of excluding or defeating political enemies rather than on the leader's positive agenda. In the second case, I think, the speaker might still be actively participating in politics, but the sense of efficacy in the first instance is imputed to another agent. It's not about your power as a citizen, it's about the leaders. And especially at the end, where they're squashing political enemies, they're viewing them as simply obstacles in the way, not to be reasoned with, not capable of changing their mind. It strikes me as quite close to the characterization of gaslighting I've given you. And if you look, as I've done with my co-author, at the 30 or so fireside chats by FDR, they actually don't always look like fireside chats. The fireplace is never really lit, but they begin in the way that we're familiar with. Roosevelt is building trust behind the banking crisis. But as those advance, and I'm not going to play the whole clip, but I think the intimacy of the radio is crucial here. And I think Twitter mimics that, and social media mimics that sense of intimacy. There's Roosevelt in the background. But let me just tell you what happens. By the 25th, 26th, later fireside chats, I think Roosevelt moves very, very powerfully from mobilizing the American electorate to something much closer to gaslighting. He starts to spend a lot of time talking about money changers, prophets of evil, big chiselers, fifth columnists in the press for his charges against the fake media, fake news, you might say today. He talks about people who should not be trusted because they're selfish men, jealous men, fearful men, and poison peddlers. And the list goes on. But he devotes so much of the speeches later to undoing the standing of others to give testimony that I think he really does show us a kind of evolution in the wrong direction. And you can see that when you contrast it with the inaugural one, which is very much the mobilization that you might take to be crucial. So I would now distinguish two ways in which gaslighting, as I described it, is actually quite different from run-of-the-mill demagoguery. And I think they're different if you look at what is called by computer hackers as surface attacks. There are different kinds of surface attacks at stake. In one of my favorite political novels, All the King's Men, there's a portrayal of a very thinly veiled Huey Long, the governor, and his demagoguery is alarming, but I want to argue it's not an instance of gaslighting. The way he electioneers manages to bypass the beliefs of the audience altogether. And let me just give you a short clip of what he's trying to do. This is the statement of what politicking is about, according to Willie Stark. Just stir them up. Doesn't matter how or why, and they'll love you and they'll come back for more. Pinch them in the soft place. They aren't alive, most of them, and they haven't been alive for 20 years. So it's up to you to give them something to stir them up and make them feel alive for just a half an hour. That's what they've come for. Tell them anything, but sweet Jesus' sake, don't try to improve their minds. And so what is happening here is that there's a statement of a kind of manipulation that, of course, is, I think, destructive to democratic citizenship, but it involves entirely bypassing the beliefs that individuals have. It's a kind of entertainment demagoguery. And it's important to note that this demagoguery is typically done with a microphone and a larger group. It's not done with the intimacy of the radio or Twitter. And I think that's an important way of separating kind of classic moments of demagoguery from what I'm describing here, because the at least faux illusion that one is in an intimate relationship with the gaslighter is a crucial prerequisite for it to make sense. And that's quite different with the formality, especially in the case of Huey Long, of the demagogue. Look how he's putting his finger in his pocket and he has that mic. It's just a fundamentally different setting. And it's, I want to argue, a different kind of manipulation. And so I want to end this section by distinguishing now three kinds of manipulation. I think that deception is a form of manipulation, but showing how they're different in politics. Obviously, I've talked about the lie as a kind of first order attack. I can go after particular propositional claims that you hold. And I argue that gaslighting can be more effective in a perverse way than the lie because it does a batch delete, right? It's able to convince you if you're colorblind, if you ought not trust this particular source, a news source or a broad swath of it, I can lead you to much more powerfully change how you are connected to the world than a simple series, a string of lies. And also, and I use this term technically by Harry Frankfurt, bullshitting, is the individual, and not unfamiliar in electoral politics, who's simply indifferent to the truth. They will use it when it supports their aims, but they will run against it and lie when it doesn't. That also is occurring at the level of propositions. What's happening here, this is why I introduced the idea of higher order evidence. The gaslighter is able to manipulate reality because they're looking at supporters and getting to tell them, subscribe to this follower, unsubscribe to this follower. I can tell you who to ascribe authority to and who not to. And the subscription model on social media is a way of doing that, producing a kind of customized news flow. That, of course, further reinforces the manipulation that I've felt. And the threat here is by going after this higher order attack, kind of higher order surface attack, you might say, that the gaslighter is able to threaten not just the individual perspective of the citizen. Remember, I described before that they would usher themselves off the deliberative stage, but collectively make the idea of appealing to a common good a kind of category mistake, right? That we don't just take ourselves to have an important position that we need to present to politics. We take ourselves to be part of at least the possibility of a good that reaches beyond us, to be part of something bigger than ourselves, we like to say. And the common good, as I've argued in print elsewhere, is a kind of way of acknowledging that there are some things that we ought to do together. And it wouldn't be the same if they were done by some third party doing them for us. And you might think that gaslighting can threaten that collective position, the we of politics that are trying to aim for a common good. I don't think you need to assume that that we all serve as a kind of group agent. I just think you have to think, if you think about the common good, that we have the possibility of acting together on some important shared ground. I want to conclude by presenting what I've shown you as a kind of dilemma with two horns that bring out the stakes of this, because I think that's really important to end with. The first horn that you face when you're a citizen is that you can allow considerable slack between your beliefs and the evidence. And that does make us susceptible to mobilization. I think that the Montgomery bus boycott would not have been possible if followers and activists didn't allow for that possible slack. The evidence was so stacked against them that, as I said, they thought it was going to be a one-day protest. It's over 380 days. So even there, they weren't audacious enough in thinking what they could have done together. But the second horn is always going to be there when we're trying to sort of act on the virtues of citizenship. And that is that if we form beliefs in a hard sort of empirically hard-headed way or hard-nosed way, and we protect ourselves from the gaslighter, it looks like by fortifying in that way, we make it harder for ourselves to view ourselves as acting together, as having hope, and we could create a kind of hopelessness, right? And if you think that part of citizenship, part of a felt need of being a citizen, is seeing our agency in our state institutions, seeing our agency in the organizations to which we belong, then this is a powerful threat, right? That if we close ourselves off from the kind of grit or audacious belief that I argued for, we may well make ourselves unavailable to be part of movements that reform our home institutions. So you can think of citizenship as having a feature and a bug in the same way, right? And I think that's what we want to bring out. The bug is our susceptibility to being told by a certain kind of manipulator who we should believe and whether we should discount in a batch way others, and often others as part of the other party or a group that's been demonized. But the feature of that, our ability to believe things that the evidence is profoundly against, is just as key. And I haven't resolved that. I think that I view this as a kind of standing challenge that we face as citizens. But I also think that that standing challenge reveals that in the ideal of citizenship, there is the exploit, which makes us vulnerable, but there's also the kind of positive counter resources to guard against it. So you might see our standing challenge is to remain open to the bully pulpit, to the persuasion of TRs, of FDRs, at least in the earlier fireside chats when he wasn't turning towards, I think, unduly manipulative techniques. But also being vigilant against the bullying. And it's a certain kind of bullying, right? I would say it's an epistemic bullying. That is, it bullies us about not just what our beliefs are, but are they grounded? Why do we hold them? And that's why you'd have to call it it's epistemic bullying, not a pretty term, but one that I think characterizes what gaslighting is fundamentally about. And so that's what I've tried to describe here. Gaslighting is a character attack, and it does threaten institutions, but it does it indirectly through ordinary citizens. So just as I said early in the beginning, that what the description of how democracies die focus on the institutional story, here we're trying to focus on a different kind of story, why democracies die, by looking at the core traits of citizenship that we all have and we aspire to. And so I offer not a sort of happy conclusion to how we should think about it, but a puzzle that I leave all of you with that I hope we can think about in the panel and the Q&A after this talk. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Professor Bierbaum. What a fantastic talk. I mean, this was really, really interesting. Thank you so much, Eric. We do have some questions that have started to come through. So if it's okay with you, I think we're just going to jump in and start working our way through them. The Q&A box is open, so feel free to put those in. If you haven't had a chance, we're going to get to as many of your good questions as we can. Again, thank you, Eric, for this really engaging and relevant talk. So the first question is from Tom Jennings, and it goes as follows. I believe Max Weber wrote a book called The True Believer. Are there people who are more vulnerable to being gaslighted? And if so, how can we bring them back to reality?
Yeah, that's beautiful. And of course, the flip side of Weber, right, is the charismatic leader. And at times his description of that can look like that. Other times the charisma is much, much more rhetorical, but it doesn't imply manipulation. But I like flipping it to the different ways we believe. I think that's right, that within any political movement, you actually want, I believe there ought to be, and we usually think this intuitively, a diversity of postures. So you actually want to have in your political movement, whether it's for the right or the left, people who are more closely hewing to the evidence, the kind of realists among you, right, who say that's not going to work, that's not going to cut it. You want others who are the dreamers, right, who are able to hold audacious beliefs even when the evidence is staring them in the face. Maybe they're in a row and they see the tear gas that's about to be fired, and they hold on to that belief that there's some path by which we succeed. So I think that there's a division of labor among any movement, whether it's institutional or otherwise, that we want. And so that's the puzzle here, is whether you can help solve the dilemma I ended with by saying, well, we can't solve this as individual citizens, but what we can do is form a coalition that has both sides. So some of us will be more tempted by this manipulation I described, because that we will be vulnerable in that way. Others will fortify us, help us as allies, and say, I think this is a case where you're not being mobilized, you are being gaslit. And so I would argue for the more collective solution, right? This diversity of roles and defending that division of labor. And I'm trying to do that with Ryan in the larger book manuscript. But I also think, I know individual citizens want to ask the question, what do I do if someone I know has gone down this route? And people often describe it as conspiracy theories, but actually I think many cases, there's no theory, right? And in fact, it's much more a story of emotional and abuse by party elites. And so I also want to have an answer that's more individuated, not simply, well, we have to do this as a collective in a movement. And that answer, honestly, is a work in progress. It's not easy. That's the final chapter of the book we're working on, is how does one help bring back people who've lost that mooring with reality? And it's the hardest chapter we've had to write. We're kind of stuck on it, to be honest.
Great, thank you. I think this next question dovetails nicely with the last, and this is from Ian, and he asks, what role should universities play in responding to gaslighting? For instance, do members of intellectual communities, students, teachers, administrators, et cetera, have a special responsibility to step into the Charlie Brown role?
I love that question. And I think that it does, the question is whether it's a microcosm of what I just said about movements. And I worry it's not, because at least my empirical colleagues, I mean, I'm the political theorist, the odd duck in a political science department, but their commitment to being something much closer to the individual that is committed as a scholar to hewing to the evidence, right? And of course, in their political lives, that could differ, but in the classroom, I think it's so important for them to honor that, what I've called a hard-nosed empiricism, what's called, that's the most appropriate stance that we often take in the context of at least the social science division of a university. And so then the question is whether in a co-curricular setting, we can encourage events that bring out the different ways that we might have permission to have slack about the evidence. So when, as advisors, we advise student groups, which I'm involved in, now that I moved my family into one of the houses here and we're dorm parents, I'm seeing a very different perspective on how we can, as academics, relate to students who actually really come with us with causes that sometimes look like the deck is stacked against them. I don't see how you're going to get this many deans to sign on to it. Or when they're outward looking, which they often are, from the Kennedy School or undergraduates at the Institute of Politics here, there I feel like my role is different than in the classroom. So there's kind of a code switching that I believe that we have to do, that I'm kind of learning as I go. But I used to pride myself that in the classroom, I would want students to never be able to guess any kind of political orientation. And I still stand by that in the following sense. I think that I would not want them to know, ideally, something like parties, party membership, and candidates in particular. But I would want them to know that, every year I teach students who are part of the DACA program. And if they weren't sure, if they thought that, well, I'm not sure if my professor wants me to be deported, I think pedagogically, I wouldn't be able to connect with them. So I think there are limits to that, that kind of neutral position in the classroom. But I would mostly stress it's the way we divide up labor between curricular and non-curricular. That seems to be the best route.
Wonderful, wonderful, thank you. So it looks like we have a follow-up question to that. So, and it reads as follows. If social scientists must be hard-nosed realists, should there be some professors that teach students to be dreamers?
Right. Do we just outsource that to the philosophers over in the humanities, right? or the English departments? Once you ask it that way, that would dissatisfy me if that kind of offshoring happened. I think there has to be a place within a social science department to bring that out. I think we do bring it out in the sense that all of our research, even of the most, and I would call them evidentialist colleagues, right? That's the official term of the epistemology. Evidentialist is someone whose beliefs and evidence are extremely tight-knit. And of course, I feel like I have a series of colleagues. I think Theda Scotchpole, I think of Daniel Carpenter, who are able to do that, right? That their work is driven in issue selection by values, and that's all of our work is. And so I think it's, I would focus on the stages of social science. So I think we can teach students to be dreamers when they're thinking about a big thesis topic, a big long form project, and we realize that they're talking to us at office hours. Of course, their values, they're are incredibly engaged. Why would they work on a subject like inequality or capital flight if they didn't care, right? But I think at that stage, that's where we have to teach, even as social scientists, the kind of dreamer side. How big can you think about what you want to take on? But then when we get to the way we're going to conduct that research, the way we're going to process the results, there I think we might have to have a different kind of attitude towards it. So maybe it's iterated within the research process, and we don't have to simply say, go off and take my colleague Michael Sandel's justice course, or that seems like it would be, it's an overly rigid picture of what we're about in social science.
Wonderful, thank you. Our next question is from John Yoon, and he asks, how are audacious beliefs or collective self-efficacy related to the virtue of hope in civic life?
I think they're what undergird it, right? And I think it's important to kind of, that this was all very abbreviated, and that when we ask, how could someone have hope when their cause looks hopeless? Or how could someone vote for a candidate when they're told the day before that they're getting marginally small, vanishingly small support, at least in the initial polling? And people still do that. They still vote for candidates who don't seem to have good chances. They still participate in causes that they think are likely to only succeed at best long after they're dead. Why would people do that? And I think there I would have to tell a story about the underlying way in which, at least as I cited the important grit book, the lowering, sort of in some ways raising the evidential threshold. So the evidence it would take for me to give up my cause has to be much more powerful than sort of run-of-the-mill polling or other kinds of data that looks against me. I mean, think of what if you'd taken the pollster data in Georgia in the runoff election. If that was playing a dominant role, you might have not gotten that outcome. And that applies to both sides who wanted to win. It's more about how does one take seriously real-time description of support for a cause or opposition to a cause? And the answer is you have to temper it. Now, I don't want to go the Canadian route, as I understand it, where you actually ban a certain amount of public polling before an election, because you, in some ways, want to lower the veil and make people, protected from the hard empirical reality. I think that's not the right way to handle it. I think it's an overly paternalistic way to treat citizens. But I also think that we then have the onus on us to process information that does suggest that our cause is unlikely to win, or that we're unlikely to even make it past the first 10 miles of the marathon. It's that kind of resistance to evidence that I think we need to tell a story about. And I think hope is parasitic upon that, right? That it actually demands that. And if I would recommend King's private journals that bring out to what extent, when he thought about the nonviolence of absolutist nonviolent view, in public, he said, look, that's the only empirical way for this to work. He kind of made an instrumental claim on behalf of nonviolence. He also made a moral claim. But actually, if you look at behind the scenes, it wasn't that simple. He realized that there were tremendous risks he was taking by having such an absolutist position towards violence. And his thought was that it was kind of a moonshot idea, right? I mean, just like the announcement that Kennedy made, we will bring a man to the moon, that seemed at the time absurd. Ike, when he heard it, said it was one of the most ridiculous utterances he'd ever, heard in public life. That's the kind of hope resistance, right, that one would have if they were overly evidentialist in this setting, right? And so I think that's something that we can protect ourselves against.
Wonderful. Thank you. Our next question is from Harper Shanley, who writes, what advice would you give to political leaders in the United States to stray away from these means of manipulation and more towards collectivity as a nation?
Yeah. I really have been thinking about how this translates into ordinary electioneering, which is something that I've worked on for a while now. And I think the canvasser example I gave points the direction towards it. But I like that example in part because it's not, it is a leader, but it's a local leader. It's someone making the neighborhood stops. And then I would ask the question of how does that scale to elite elites with much bigger megaphones, which with many millions of followers, and how can they in that setting appreciate the hazards? And I think that's the first step, and that to realize that the kind of facsimile intimacy that people experience in social media is reminiscent of the radio. It's actually much more intimate, I think, than broadcast television. And so to realize that this channel of communication is one where it is easier to engage in this kind of manipulation because people believe that they're in a pairwise relationship with the person they're subscribing to. And it they have more interaction with that person, interaction obviously in scare quotes, than many of their friends. In a typical day, they might get a dozen tweets from that person. And so that then creates this sense that we have this intimate connection. And of course, that can be, like I said earlier, a feature that, that you can utilize that to bring out a sense of collective efficacy, but you can also very easily, and I think without fully realizing what you're doing, fall into it. I was very surprised as I listened to these fireside chats that they turned in this direction. And obviously I have to make the evidence for it. I just telegraphed it. But we try to argue something similar happened in the context of the Lincoln Douglas debates. I mean, there were so many, they were 3 hours each, and they began much more optimistically tapping in the hope style beliefs of those listening. Of course, it's not clear how many were able to actually hear Lincoln Douglas in those settings, but they, you know, but I think that as, and this may be another lesson, as leaders get exhausted from politics, which current politics, we've designed it so it is truly, it is akin to a marathon, that their defenses, it becomes much more tempting to use this kind of technique because it's easier, it's cheap. It can lead to, as I said, a sort of batch delete, and knowing that you're not allowed to use it, in particular when your opponent might be using it, is a particular challenge. And that's one that I, is a kind of note to self, I wanna work on that. You know, I haven't argued that gaslighting is never allowed, right? I've argued that it is a defeasible wrong, and it's often a very grave wrong. But in an electoral setting where one experiences it, is there any condition under which one is then licensed to respond in kind? I'm not committed to that view, but I haven't foreclosed it. And I think that's perhaps the most tempting moment for the question raises, is that if I have to unilaterally disarm this kind of manipulation, is this going to doom me to be out of power in a state like this that is so hyper-polarized, that has this rich, you know, oxygen environment as a metaphor? So in some ways, I've just kind of taken the question as a very difficult challenge. How do you respond when it's so tempting to deploy this? And I hope I've shown that it is, in some ways, part of the explanation of why a term that's from an obscure play and a movie that no one is on Twitter, these are younger generation typically, have seen, has had millions of usages in peak days on social media. I just think it's part of our responsibility as political theorists, as social scientists, to kind of give the best explanation. What are they trying to do with this term of moral abuse? And this is just an early draft of that attempt to make sense of what people are actually saying in politics.
Wonderful, thank you, Eric. This is really fascinating. So I do want to note that we have about 5 minutes left before we're going to take a break and then continue with our panel discussion at 5:30. So if you have any questions you want to make sure to get in, go ahead and put those in the Q&A box. We still have a lot to get through, so we're not going to get to all of them, but thanks to all of you who have presented your questions. The next one is from Bonnie Green. How can an individual with absolute irrefutable facts that fit neither partisan paradigm effectively communicate so that we could come back to some level of reality?
Right. So the example I gave where it may not be like the stove case, where one can find another route back because you can ask whether you clean the stove. And so that raises the issue of, can one actually be lost? I took the question to be, you know, asking, you know, is, and I, as an optimist, maybe that's part of behind this research, I can't admit that kind of defeat. I think that, you know, that it's true that in the, even in the play, in the movie, there is at the end the possibility of redemption, right? That and the question is, how overwhelming and how variegated must the evidence be for one to realized I was in the grip of a particular kind of manipulator. And I think that, I mean, because that is what happens in the original storyline, it does give us a kind of point of direction, which is that an overwhelming kind of intervention, whether by friends and family or fellow, I don't want to say partisans, because in fact, it would be much better if it was a bipartisan intervention. But that seems to be at the very intimate sort of local level, what it might take. And obviously I haven't said how it worked, but I do think the model of an intervention probably in the case of substance abuse is not a terrible one to work off of. I guess the question that I would leave is whether there's a collective analog to that. You know, are there moments when we experience as a nation events that are so so scarring and powerful that it actually leads to fundamental questioning in this kind of dependence relationship I described? And I think it's too early whether the Capitol insurrection had that effect. I think there's some early evidence that it did. And I want to be absolutely clear that now that there's Democratic control of Washington, there's plenty of other ways this manipulation can occur. We stress in this work that there's no proprietary monopoly on this kind of manipulation. And that's why we actually have some more Democratic characters in American history than Republicans who are making these cameo appearances in the work. But I would suggest that when you have such a sort of powerful and shocking moment in our civic history to see that picture. And I when I look for pictures for this talk, to see the one at night, right, with the which reminds you of how long it was, the insurrection took, you know, how long and how undefended we were. And then in the other side of it, NPR has put together a database of every individual person who's been arrested, and not just the crimes they're charged with, but what their social media said. And I think I wasn't able to go through it here, but there's some pretty powerful evidence of manipulation. And I actually think part of the story here is that we focus too much upon people self-deceiving, self-manipulating, going down a QAnon or some other conspiratorial route. I think this is much more of a third party wrongdoing. I think there's much less blame to be had, or at least there's collective, you know, kind of complicity charges that occur. Whereas people often say, well, they went down the rabbit hole. Well, that implies that they weren't being led by very powerful actors. So I'm in some ways trying to correct against that line, which at least I sometimes get the sense of. That doesn't absolve anyone of blame who led to the death of a Capitol cop or anything like that. But it does suggest that we have the kind of moral reckoning after it is going to be more complex and will involve distributing blame and guilt and complicity across a greater number of actors than maybe the story sometimes is brought out.
Fantastic. So I really like this next question. So I know we're out of time. I'm going to ask it, and maybe you can give just a very quick response to it. But it's an interesting one. It's from Richard Allman, and he asks, how important is a strong commitment to free speech in the prevention of gaslighting? How might we mandate equal time for debate when there are different interpretations of available evidence? There's a long history in which the interpretations of the elite smart group has been wrong and have delayed the advancement of science, the discovery of truth. He then cites example of peptic ulcers, which was denied for a long time until science proved it. So is there something that we can do to ensure that different perspectives are put on display in a way that's consistent with free speech?
And yeah, the kind of dogmatic dependence that relationship I've talked about that can occur within gaslighting does suggest that's a paramount view of free speech. And on campus, I'm part of a group that's trying to encourage that. But I think that can sometimes cut against the equal time or the fair time constraints, right? That in some ways it brings out two ways to respond to the problem. One says, you know, one makes, I think, maybe a mistaken appeal to marketplace of ideas, right? Idea, just kind of let as many groups speak as they want. And the counter one says, no, have events that require multiple sides. And I think, I can't arbitrate among that, but you would have to ask whether those two kinds of environments, which one is more likely to help correct against this, would hold people accountable. I take that as a future work to do on what are these deliberative structures that we need that take seriously the threat that I've talked about. So thank you for that.
Great, fantastic. Well, just an amazing presentation. Timely, engaging, relevant for this conference. Thank you so much, Eric. And thank you to those who asked questions. Sorry we didn't get to everybody. everybody, but we're glad you're engaged. And thank you for being here and for presenting your questions. Thank you, Eric.